Hi there, John Wilkes here, and before we get started with this week's episode of the Old Songs podcast, I just wanted to clear up a little thing. Some of you may have received an email over the last week or so that says the Old Songs podcast will no longer be on Mixcloud or something to that effect. I just wanted to say it will remain on Mixcloud because Mixcloud is the only platform that actually makes sure that the artists that we include receive some kind of royalty. The thing that's changing is that if you've been subscribing and supporting financially the Old Songs podcast, for which I'm very grateful indeed, the way that you do that is going to change from now on. I'm not going to do that via the Mixcloud select service. I'm doing it via Bandcamp. So if you were to go to my Bandcamp page, which is johnwilkes.bandcamp.com, John Wilkes is J-O-N rather than J-O-H-N, so johnwilkes.bandcamp.com, then you can subscribe there, and that's the way to support the creation of the podcast. Thanks very much for listening. Hello there. You might say that this week's episode of the Old Songs podcast is waterlogged with nostalgia. Round number 9435 is better known as The Leaving of Liverpool, and it's one of those folk songs that have, at various points in its history, managed to weigh anchor and ship off into a larger consciousness. Okay, so I'll stop with the strange nautical metaphors now, but the story behind this song of longing and homesickness, well, it's a journey in and of itself, full of twists and turns, made all the more fascinating by the fact that it was only ever collected twice, both times within the same harbour and possibly even within the same few days. And yet, it's a song that has been sung by many thousands of people across the English-speaking world pretty much ever since. Unusually for the Old Songs podcast, this is a song that I chose to speak about, rather than asking the interviewee singer to choose it for me, and I knew exactly who I wanted to chat to about it. As we're about to hear, it's a song that was once ubiquitous, but seems to have been somewhat neglected in recent years, possibly until Jim Murray recorded a version on his 2019 album The Outlander. And when Jim came to the Whitchurch Folk Club here in Hampshire and performed it in October last year, well, there wasn't a dry eye in the house, and it's kind of been stuck in my head ever since. Perhaps it's because the world feels so off-kilter these days that I wanted to get stuck into a song that tugs and pulls at the heartstrings and almost weighs you down with yearning and emotion. Whatever the reasons, it was a delight to chat to Jim Murray this morning about this gorgeous piece of music, and perhaps reintroduce it to the listeners of the Old Songs podcast once again. So, batten down the hatches, sorry I promised, didn't I? Hoist the mainsail, we're heading for the wide ocean.
So fare thee well, my old true love. When I return, united we will be. It's not the leaving of Liverpool that grieves me, but my darling, when I...
So welcome back, Jim.
Thank you.
And I wanted
nice to be back.
I wanted to get you back because the first time you were on it, you were wildly popular.
Oh, really?
So many people listened.
That's a first.
I don't believe that for a second. But yeah, we had so many people listen to that one. And also, you've been a part of it from the very beginning anyway.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like it's partly yours.
Oh, well, I don't know about that, but yeah, I mean, I remember having a conversation with you at your folk club about your podcast idea. Mm. So I've been really enjoying listening to all of the episodes.
Lovely,
but yeah, it's really nice to be back.
This
thank
one's
you to everybody who listened to the last one, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this one's slightly different because all of the other ones I've asked other people to choose the song themselves.
Yeah,
and in this one, I've kind of said to you, there's a song that I'd really like to talk about.
Okay.
And you obviously know what it is.
Yeah.
I'm not just going to throw it at you, just throw a random song at you. But the reason for this is that I think actually when you came to my folk club in a Whitchurch folk club in, I think it was October last year, in autumn certainly, you performed this song and it was on your latest album.
Yeah.
And it got me in a way that I hadn't expected it to. And I think it's to do with a sort of a buried sense of nostalgia for having heard the song, because my family are from, well, part of my family are from Liverpool, and I think I heard this song when I was little. So the song is Round Number 9435, and it's called The Leaving of Liverpool, or LOL, as it's written in my notes.
Yeah, it's interesting, because it's not a song I would have picked to talk about necessarily. Mm. And I think the reason for that is, at various points in my career, in inverted commas, my career,
I've got
quite a lot of mileage out of songs that are were so ubiquitous at some point in time, but people don't sing anymore.
Mm.
So my first record, the opening track on my record Sweet England, was a version of Early One Morning, which people used to learn at school if they're of a certain age, and B was in an episode of Some Mothers Do Have 'Em. But as a result, it's one that everybody thinks is old hat, but on the same time, no one ever sings anymore. And I think I find those songs really interesting, the ones that are so ingrained in people's psyche, but that as a result have been almost silent for sort of 20 years, 30 years.
Do you have other examples? It's obviously LOL, Leaving of Liverpool.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of good examples. I mean, I suppose there have been a few versions recently, a few interesting versions recently of the Wild Rover.
Mm.
But that's something that I think at a certain point of sort of folk, commercial folk recording, you wouldn't have done a version of the Wild Rover.
Mm.
So that's a good example of sometimes they're recordings of songs that force the audience to reassess a song, and you know, you can get a bit of mileage out of that. Sometimes it's an interesting, you know, an interesting version that they might not have heard. But the ones that I think, so a song like The Leaving of Liverpool or Early One Morning or The Wild Rover are ones that have almost gone beyond the folk scene in a way.
Mm.
You know, like, what's a good example of a song that everybody that might be in my audience has heard, but if you're just somebody who only has a passing interest in music even, it wouldn't have reached their consciousness.
There's a couple that strike me from stuff, you know, from the time that I've been involved in this. It's an interesting sort of point in that I think there's perhaps a snobbery around some of these songs. So
yeah, that is definitely part of it.
This came to me, so when I started recording traditional songs myself, I recorded a version of The Hard Times of Old England, which I've already talked about on this podcast. And a prominent folky musician said to me that they would never choose to record that song because everybody's done it. It's far too obvious.
Yeah, there we go.
But to me, as somebody who was coming to it new, it was an astounding song that I was just thinking, why does the world not know about this song?
Exactly.
But of course, the folk world does. Brown is another one, actually. Shallow Brown is one that I think is just such an exquisitely gorgeous song. And, you know, certainly in the times that we're living at the moment with the Black Lives Matter movement, it's a song that just sort of strikes me as being something why does nobody know this?
Yeah, I'd not thought of that. Yes, I mean, there is a whole subset of songs which seem oversung to people who are very interested in folk music and know everything that's going on.
Mm.
But, you know, I come back to this idea of... I come back to a thing about, you know, about guitar bands in the 90s, you'll be surprised to know, about how can something be retro if you're 18 and you've never heard it before?
Right,
it seems like exciting, you know, four boys with guitars wearing leather jackets seems exciting if you're 18 and you've never, you know, you didn't live through it
the last time
and the time before that.
Yeah.
There's a similar thing in folk, like you say, of The Hard Times of Old England. If you've never heard it before, it's a stunning song.
Mm.
But, you know, I suppose there is probably an element in it of if you were around folk clubs in the 80s or 90s, you've probably heard a song like that done well a few times and done you know, less well a lot of times and done badly a good few times as well. And that, I think, you know, dulls people's memory. And I think that very much applies to The Leaving of Liverpool. It seems, I mean, there's a snobbery because it's a song that has travelled outside the folk scene and is something that people with, you know, the average person might have heard of. There's also the thing that it's been a floor singer, open mic, you know, session sing-along staple at various points in folk history.
Yeah. So is that how you came to it then? So you must have memories, I suppose, of being a young kid being taken
to
folk.
You know what? I don't know, actually. I couldn't tell you where I first heard this song. It's something that just sort of entered my brain by osmosis, but I can't... You know, it's not something I've paid much attention to, I don't think, or not until I moved to Liverpool anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I do find those songs quite fascinating, really.
Well, this is something we usually go to the end of the podcast to ask these kind of questions, but maybe it's interesting to talk about it up front, because you are sitting there in Liverpool and we're recording this over Skype.
Yes.
And so you are in Liverpool. So I assume, and certainly from what you've just said, that it popped back into your head because of that association. Is that right?
It popped back into my head because I was looking for songs with Liverpool in the title.
Mm.
I just specifically wanted to... I think I was looking what was out there. I just had a... When I moved here, I had a curiosity about what the quintessential Liverpool folk songs were.
Mm.
Which I think is something we'll probably talk about where a song is actually from.
Mm.
But this, obviously, because it's in the title, it has an association with here.
Yeah, I said to you before we did this recording that, you know, my grandmother is in her early 90s, and my mother, obviously, also from Liverpool, and I went to them and said to them, this song, Leaving of Liverpool, tell me about this. Do you remember this being sung around the pianos in Speak when you were kids and that kind of thing, or any memories? And Grandma said, I don't think it's an old song. I don't really know it.
Oh, interesting.
And I said, can you tell me any Liverpool folk songs? And neither of them could do very much. Now, that's partly because, I think, because they're not necessarily folk from the folk tradition themselves or particularly involved in it. They were both able to give a fairly raunchy rendition of Maggie May, but I think my mum's version of that probably comes from the Beatles having recorded a version of that.
Yeah.
And they couldn't go much further than that. And it does seem to me, and maybe I'm totally wrong here, but it does seem to me that when I've kind of looked at Liverpool songs, just in the scant bit of research I've done here, there seems to be far fewer than you might expect.
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, I'm far from an expert on the folk music of Liverpool. I've only been here for 3 or 4 years.
Hmm.
And, you know, and I think the landscape is very different. So, you know, there are people listening to this who will have firsthand knowledge of what the folk scene in Liverpool was like in the 1960s.
Yes, I can imagine. But from what I understand, people getting quite het up by all the stuff I've just said. Sorry about that. There's probably loads of Liverpool folk songs.
But Liverpool is a place that had very much had a sort of folk explosion when folk clubs took off. So we're talking the early 60s onwards, and there were a couple of huge mega clubs, sort of the same as there were in Birmingham. In Birmingham, there was a club called the Jug of Punch, which people still talk about, that was run by Ian Campbell, Campbell Folk Group, which included Dave Swarbrick when he was a teenager, and Dave Pegg, who went on to be in Fairport Convention when he was a teenager.
Yeah.
But this place, you know, like huge audience and hugely important and a weekly club. Liverpool had a club run by the Spinners and another one run by a couple called Jackie and Bridie that people still talk about in hushed tones. But these are big venues with big weekly audiences.
Mm.
But the Spinners in particular. And I think there is a similar thing that happened in the Northeast. I don't know if you know of Graham Miles, the songwriter.
I don't.
So the Northeast having big folk clubs and him wondering where all of the folk songs from Teesside were.
Yeah.
And then sort of scratching away at the surface and discovering there weren't as many as he thought there should be. Mm. So Graham Miles started to write them about sort of local events and local legends and the history of the place. But because he was such a good songwriter, they sort of entered the consciousness as being the traditional songs of Teesside.
Yeah.
So, you know, Graham Miles is the good example over there. Around here, there was a guy called Stan Kelly.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of Liverpool folk songs. I mean, specifically, when I moved here, I bought a book called Liverpool Folk Songs, which stupidly I've left downstairs. But, you know, there are only a few traditional ones in it, but there are lots that were written by Stan Kelly about how the casting of the liver birds that sit on top of the liver building.
Yeah.
That were written by Stan Kelly in 1962 and then were taken up by this folk club and became sing-alongs and became big deals. So I think there are a lot of Liverpool folk songs which are actually inventions of the mid-1960s, really.
And Stan Kelly's really obvious one, certainly that I know of, is...
Yeah.
The Liverpool lullaby, "Oh, you are a lucky kid, dirty as a dusting lid."
Yeah,
which comes
and
from
that's a good example.
Newcastle.
Because because it's a traditional tune that somebody has taken, or well, Stan Kelly has taken and has made about his locality. Mm. So it's taking bits of traditional songs, and that is the folk process, really. It's taking bits and altering them and passing them on in a different form. That's, in a really simplistic sense, what the folk process is.
And we're going to see that with this song, I think.
Yeah, certainly quite possibly.
From the notes that I've been hurrying together. I've got 8 pages of notes here, so I think we've got a lot of talking.
Yeah, this is going to be one where you know far more than me about this song. My relationship to this song is a lot more kind of cursory. I don't have a lot of sea songs in my repertoire, but it is something I'm really interested in.
Mm.
So I've collected together a few things about sea songs in general. But this song I think of as a quintessentially Liverpool song. And when you trace it back, the reason for that is because it's got Liverpool in the title and because of the Spinners' influence. So the Spinners were on TV a lot as well in the late 60s. I don't know if you know that Russ Abbott sketch, which is a pastiche of the Spinners.
Well, I remember Russ Abbott quite well, but I don't know that I would remember or have known that it was meant to be a pastiche. So I'll go back and look.
Yeah, it's one that, hey, might not be on YouTube anymore after the last couple of weeks. It's a slightly racist sketch.
Right, got you. Okay.
So for people, if there's anybody out there who don't know the Spinners were 4 guys. I'm trying to remember their names. Huey Jones, Mick Groves, Cliff Hall, and I'm trying to remember the 4th member. I'm really sorry to have forgotten the 4th member. But they played guitars and they sang in harmony. Cliff Hall was from somewhere in the Caribbean,
right.
And had come over here in the RAF and stayed. So they sang a lot of Northwest folk songs. They sang a lot of, and they all wore matching sweaters and they played their guitars and banjos. But Cliff Hall sang a lot of Caribbean folk songs.
Right.
But the fact that there was a Russ Abbott sketch, so it's the reason I say it's a slightly racist sketch is it's because it's Russ Abbott and was he called Dustin G?
Yeah,
and
Dustin G.
Les Dennis, and but anyway, one of them is in blackface as Cliff Hall.
Got you.
And the line is that they all get to wear matching jumpers, but one of them gets to wear the coloured one.
Right, I see.
But
okay.
I just think the fact that this sketch was on primetime, the biggest comedy show, or one of the biggest comedy shows of the time, and everybody knew what they were referring to.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think that's the sort of reach that folk music doesn't often have.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So,
that's a real testament.
But the Spinners obviously were a big deal here, and they sang a lot of sea songs, and they were important beyond the folk scene. They were sort of ambassadors for traditional music for better or for worse.
Mm.
Because they created this idea that it was all people, that thing of people in Aran sweaters with their fingers in their ear.
Yeah.
That's largely down to the Spinners being on TV a lot. You know, it's a song I associated with that sort of folk music, the sort of the stuff you sing in, the stuff that people were taught in school, the stuff that's old hat and wasn't on the folk scene. You know, I can't think of a time when I heard people doing, you know, floor spots or a sing around singing the Leaving Liverpool, because by the time I was a child, it was already old hat.
Yeah, yeah. So you've brought it back.
Well, I just had a curiosity about it, really. I knew it was one with a rousing chorus, and that is something I don't have a lot of in my repertoire. So I thought, oh, Leaving Liverpool, how about that? So I went looking for recordings, and you know, we're maybe fast forwarding to stuff that we would have talked about later in the podcast. Mm. But the thing that was the eye opener, and I think when people hear it, they'll realise where I got my ideas from, is there is an amazing recording by Steve Tilston.
Right. Okay.
So Steve Tilston was from Merseyside originally, but spent a lot of his formative years in Bristol. So has links with a lot of people I used to know in Bristol. Oh, I still do know in Bristol.
Because you lived there as well, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that, you know, there are a lot of parallels, and it is a great, you know, great songwriter. But he did an album of other people's songs. I think the album is called Of Many Hands.
Right.
But anyway, he did a version of the Leaving of Liverpool on that, which cast it in a completely different light, a sort of slower, jazzier Leaving of Liverpool, which I really like. And that sort of made me go, oh, no, I can see my way into this song.
Farewell to you, my own true love. I'm sailing far away. I am bound for California, but I will return someday. Yes, I'm bound.
Okay, well, let's get going on where it comes from. So,
okay,
because you've just made a really interesting point that sort of people, when you start looking up the Leaving of Liverpool, you often come across this idea. First of all, this notion that it's an Irish song, it's really common. So if you start Googling Leaving of Liverpool, it often comes up what Irish song Leaving of Liverpool, such and such.
Yeah.
So you've got this sort of group of people who have this belief that it's Irish. You've got this obvious connection with it being English because it's got Liverpool in the title, and more so, it in one of the versions of the song, it makes direct reference to certain places in Liverpool.
I mean, I would say that is quite an interesting point, because the thing about Liverpool, as opposed to every other city that I've lived in, is that it is a place where, you know, in fact, that there were even people on a protest yesterday carrying banners that said "Scouse, not English."
Mm.
That is a huge pervading attitude here, that it's somehow that Liverpool is a sort of little separatist state within England.
A so bit like Cornwall, you know, I think, or something like that.
Yeah, so you know, a song, it's possible for the song to be Irish and from Liverpool,
right?
And
right,
for
right.
that to be a completely consistent
feeling. But on a completely surface level, you might make the assumption that it's English, because to most people, Liverpool is an English seaport.
Yes.
And also,
yeah, all I'm saying is probably not to a large proportion of Scousers.
Yes, okay. Well, worth caveating. Yeah. And then you have where it's collected, and this is where it gets really fascinating, because it and you drew my attention to this, because I didn't realize this. It was only collected twice, and it was collected in the same place, a small area of New York, from two ship captains who were of North American origin. And so you've got this, I mean, before we turned the recording on, you were talking to me about how it could be seen as an American song. So straight away, you've got this idea that it could be Irish, it could be English, it could be American, and yet it was only collected in two places, which is, you know, usually when we're talking about this stuff on the Old Songs podcast, we're talking about songs that are collected in hundreds of places.
Yeah, and collected quite late as well.
Yes,
you know, 1942, I think, Richard Maitland was recorded.
Yeah, yeah, late 30s, early 40s, yeah.
Yeah. So, I think sea songs are interesting, because for any island nation, you know, it's sort of natural that they have an obsession with the sea in their traditional music stories and everything, because it's the defining factor that's never going to change. But sea songs are also interesting because they're where all of the outside influences come in.
Mm.
You know, sailors that have gone off somewhere else and have brought a song back with them, or brought stuff with them, are the things that nudge the dial on culture and you know.
Yes, it's. I mean,
obviously, immigration and emigration hugely shape are the things that shape the culture, but also just people visiting. You know, it's sailors bringing stuff back. Are the things that change the feel of a culture.
Yeah,
if
we go back even a few minutes, we talked about Shallow Brown, and you take when I first came to Shallow Brown, and I was interested in the idea that it had been collected in a specific place, and I found that it was collected in Portsmouth Workhouse, I think it was, at least one version was, and yet you're quite clearly dealing with a song which sounds like it's got sort of you know, slaver origins. It seems to be sung by somebody who is captive on a slave ship, potentially. Yeah. I mean, there's all sorts you could read into it. But but why it's turned up in Portsmouth in a workhouse, sung by a white guy, is endlessly fascinating.
Fare thee well, I am bound to leave. Shallow Brown. Fare thee well, I'm bound to leave you. Shallow Brown. My master's going to sell me. Shallow Brown. Yes, my master's going to sell me. Shallow Brown.
All of these sea songs are, you know, quite often when we talk about shanties, we're talking about work songs. And I certainly know from my time living in Japan that when you go and you explore Japanese traditional music is nearly always to do with work. So it's
is
quite
it really?
Often, it's
That's
quite
really
often,
interesting.
It's quite often the work songs are quite often, or the traditional songs are associated with rice planting. So it's sort of backbreaking work in a field where people have to do stuff on a regular monotonous sort of process. Or it'll be sea shanties, their version of, you know, Japanese traditional version of sea shanties. I really, you know, when lockdown's over and you get the chance again, there's a wonderful Japanese drumming troupe called Kodo who do world tours every couple of years. And if you ever get the chance to go and see Kodo, They do these, it's just incredible performances in, like, you know, just of Japanese taiko drumming, but interspersed between the songs, you'll get Japanese sea shanties, and you really can feel the similarity between Japanese sea shanties and our sea shanties, in the sense that they're...
It totally makes sense. When I said about, you know, island nations, I think, you know, that makes total sense that Japan would have quite a strong sea song flavor to traditional music.
I mean, only I think what's quite interesting from what I know about English traditional and British traditional songs is that actually our work songs, by which I mean, and certainly when you go back to what you've just mentioned in terms of spirituals and sort of things that were perhaps part of black chain gangs in the States and that kind of things, these are very much work songs that are about trying to drive people forwards, and we don't tend to have a huge amount of that in traditionally British stuff other than sea shanties. I think I'm right in saying that.
I don't know, I'd have to look into that, actually. That's a really interesting train of thought. So musically, the pattern of what we think of as shanties quite often are, you can break them down into different categories, but that idea of a second and fourth line chorus, so there is Shallow Brown being a good case in point. There's a solo line and then the crew sing back a repeating line, and then another solo line and then the crew sing back a second repeating line. And that as a pattern in English traditional music is pretty common. There's different types of shanties. I've got the booklet here from a guy called Eric Eilot, who was actually the last Bristol shanty man. And he made this record in 1973. But this is one of my favourite sort of references for sea songs, and I'm still sort of working my way through this record. There are two main types of work songs. Those to help along work which required a turning action, so capstan, windlass and pump shanties, and songs designed to help men with hauling on the halyards, sheets, etc. So I think hauling shanties are that second and fourth line chorus, that's what you'd associate with it. And then there's a third category, which is where I think the Leaving of Liverpool fits in, which he describes as four-bitters, called forecastle shanties, which is a shortening of forecastle, which is the bit of the ship when, you know, they're leisure shanties, basically, all of the work is done, sitting around singing. And he says here, four-bitters, for his enjoyment in times of leisure, the seamen sang songs known as four-bitters or cargo hatch songs. These songs were more often than not in some way connected with the fair sex on whom, in times of leisure, our minds often dwelt. I have sat for hours on watch listening to a fellow seaman's love life in all its intimate details. But yeah, I mean, it's a huge factor in how these songs sound, I think, the context that they were sung in.
So when you go into the details on the leaving of Liverpool, as we said, we've got two versions, only two versions, and we were fortunate enough. This is, I mean, the story to this song twists and turns. It's amazing, especially amazing given that there's only two versions that were recorded. But actually, the version that most people know does seem to have been a four-bitter, as you've just mentioned, a song that was heard. Yeah. And then only in relatively recent years has more research come to light to show that the version that most people don't know was actually a work song, a shanty. And we'll come on to that a little bit later, because there's some really fascinating quotes that we could read out about that. But let's just spin back to where it comes from. So, well, we've done the bit about the nationality of it and how, you know, I think it's almost impossible to say if it does have a nationality, and it probably was born on the high seas in any way.
Well, it strikes me as being one of those songs that is the product of where things have changed. So when you look at the songs that Cecil Sharp and Maud Carpley's collected in the Appalachians, so, you know, towards the end of his life, Cecil Sharp went off to try and find songs that were British in origin, but had survived with settlers in, you know, in the US.
Yes.
And they, you know, there's a train of thought which runs that those songs had been preserved more how they were at the time of these people emigrating than the surviving versions in the British Isles.
Mm.
And there's another train of thought which is that they absorbed more influences and they'd sort of evolved in a different direction. So, you know, so like a evolution in living beings, they had a common ancestor and they'd gone in different directions. And this song does I have nothing to base this on other than gut feeling.
Mm.
But the way the melody and the words are arranged, it does feel very similar to those songs of British origin that were collected in the Appalachian Mountains and they've got a flavour all of their own.
Right, okay.
So you know, it probably is a sort of, it feels like it might be a song that does have an origin somewhere, but we can't retrace exactly where.
Yeah.
But probably in the British Isles, well, you know, judging by the title and the words, it probably is in the British Isles somewhere. But they're a sort of pan-Scottish, Irish, English-flavoured American song. That's my feeling.
Okay. So what I'm going to do now is rattle through some of these notes that I've got, because otherwise we could get bogged down,
sure.
Really.
Yeah.
And before I do that, I need to just really highlight that this largely comes from the work of a chap called Stephen Rennick. And Stephen Rennick turned up for me in the conversation that I had with Lisa Knapp recently about Hal and Toe, because that's the first time he came to light for me. He was he had done a blog that was very interesting and raised some interesting points about that. But Stephen Rennick is the editor of the Library of Congress Folklife Center newsletter, which I think is more than just a sort of email newsletter. It looks like it's a fairly hefty tome.
Yeah, he's quite an eccentric chap. I've met him.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I don't mean Stephen Rennick. I mean Stephen Winnick.
Steve Winnick, yes, that's right. So he works at the Library of Congress. I met him at Folk Alliance conference in Toronto.
Mm.
But yeah, he's hugely knowledgeable about all sorts of things, you know, as you'd expect, as somebody who's worked their entire life at the Library of Congress.
Mm.
But yeah, he's a very active blogger and very active writer on traditional music and sort of curator. He's a great guy.
So cool. Okay, so I really want to underline that most of what I'm going to be talking about from my notes is really just a sort of paraphrasing of what Stephen Winnick has written, and people can go and find this huge wonderful article on the Library of Congress, the American Folklife Center website. So the first place to sort of start really is that the collector of the song was a chap called William Dolflinger. I'm bound to get these pronunciations wrong, but William Dolflinger was a scholar of languages at Princeton. And I like this. He split his spare time between folk song collecting and stage magic.
Yeah.
So, you know,
that's amazing.
If you're ever thinking, Jim, that perhaps you need something new for your act, there's possibly.
Well, yeah.
I wonder if you can collect stage magic tricks in the same way that you can collect songs, and if you ever
well,
did it.
You probably can, actually. I think there's probably, from what I know about sort of stage magic and illusions, I think there is a similar sort of culture of you know, because it is quite, the history of it is quite an academic thing as well.
Yeah,
you know, so, who came up with what and who based something on someone else's idea.
So it's quite possible that he combined his his interests. And in fact, he did. When he went to Nova Scotia to do some song collecting, he supported himself by doing stage magic.
Brilliant. So I mean, I think it's really interesting as well, though, that he's a professor of language, because that's what Child was, you know, an American professor of English.
Yeah.
And that they consider it a branch of sort of English literature history.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, definitely. Well, his thesis was called Shanty Men and Shanty Boys, and he wrote that in 1931.
If anybody wants to form a sort of you know, boy band sea shanty troupe, the Shanty Boys is a brilliant name.
Yeah. One for the future.
Shanty Men and Shanty Boys. It's the Las Vegas show, isn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does sound a little camp. It was also the Shanty Men and Shanty Boys, the thesis was published in 1951 as a book, and it was hugely, hugely influential. So it took 20 years to come to publication, but it was hugely influential on that folk song revival. And I would have thought that it was hugely influential on the folk song revival in the States, but actually this is where the twists and turns start happening.
Mm.
So this version that he recorded came from a captain called Richard Maitland, or Dick Maitland.
Yeah.
And there's not a huge amount of biographical knowledge, biographical detail I can find about Richard Maitland, other than that he was a kind of sea dog. And
but he was Derflinger found him at a sort of seaman's mission, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, so there was this little place called, I think it was called the Sailor's Snug.
Sailor's Snug, brilliant. It's,
I mean, all of this is almost like, you know, if you wanted to write a really bad sort of version of Moby Dick or something, you would just put all these names in. But
so... Yeah, Sailor's Snug Harbour, Staten Island.
That's right, yeah. So, and he found both of the singers there, and they both had this song, and he found them possibly within days, months, even years, but he didn't seem to take notes on when he actually found them. It just says vaguely late 1930s, early 1940s. But Dick Maitland's version is the version that most people knew, and here's why most people knew it. It's basically down to technological failure. Derflinger recorded two machines, basically. He borrowed one machine, recording machine, off the Library of Congress. And everything that belonged to the Library of Congress, in terms of the machine and the recordings and the discs that they lent him, meant that that whatever he recorded ended up in their possession.
Sure, yeah.
And he also had another machine on which he recorded other stuff, which ended up in his own possession. So when he recorded... the other guy, which was a guy called Patrick Taylor, I'm not sure how to pronounce that. I'm just going to say Taylor because I think it's a version of that. The recording of Patrick Taylor went with the Library of Congress, and we'll come on to that in a minute because that has its own twists and turns. The version that he got off Richard Maitland, he published in his thesis, which went into his book. That version was obtained within 10 years. It was obtained by Ewan McColl. And Ewan McColl selected that song from that book for an album that he was making with Burt Lloyd, an album called A Sailor's Garland, and that was released in 1962. So in that period of time, the song has already flipped back to the UK to be recorded by these guys. So for that session, he brought in Louis Killen. And Louis Killen was brought in as a sort of harmony singer for that song.
Leaving of Liverpool that grieves me, but me darling, when I think on you.
Now Louis Killen, she recorded it again in 1963, and she started singing it out and singing it around and about in the clubs. Killen taught it to a chap called Luke Kelly, who was later a member of the Dubliners.
Yep.
Luke Kelly sang it to his friends, who included members of the Dubliners who he was yet to join, and he also sang it to Liam Clancy. Liam Clancy was a member of the Clancy Brothers. He went back to the States because he often sang in the Greenwich Village circuit. So he takes it back to the States, and the song is returned to America again. Now, both the Dubliners and the Clancy Brothers recorded a version of it, Which is on the surface possibly how it comes to be thought of as an Irish song, because people would make those associations. Meanwhile, in Greenwich Village, a young chap called Bob Dylan, he hears it, and he's either heard it, well, nobody's really sure, because obviously Bob Dylan doesn't talk very much about himself, but he's a little bit insular.
Oh, that's a whole other topic.
But Bob Dylan hears it either during his stint in London in the early 60s when he was hanging out with people like Martin Carthy and possibly seeing people like Louis Killen, or more likely he heard the Clancy Brothers singing it in Greenwich Village.
Yeah.
And he rewrote it, as was his wont, into a song called Farewell.
Yeah.
Which he never released on an official album at that time. But he did sing it in concerts a lot, and it's turned up a lot on bootlegs. And you can now easily get recordings, live recordings of Dylan singing this song, Farewell, which has almost exactly the same chorus and has the same tune, but is, as Dylan's style, it's all Dylan's lyrics.
Oh, it's fairly well, my darling true. I'm leaving in the first hour of the morn. I'm bound off for the Bay of Mexico, or maybe the coast of California. So it's fairly well, my own true love. We'll meet another day, another time. It ain't the leaving that's agreed. But my darling, who's bound to stay behind?
By the mid-60s, and with sort of further help from the Spinners, who you mentioned earlier, the song is suddenly back in all the folk clubs. So that's a very kind of rough-potted history of how it turned up in the larger consciousness. So now let's go back to where the song came from, just in terms of the guys back in the sailor's snug. So Derflinger recorded it recorded Dick Maitland between 38 and 40. Dick Maitland's age was not given, but he was born in New York's Bloody Fourth Ward. That's a great little phrase. I don't know if Bloody Fourth Ward was the full title, or it was just the Fourth Ward and it was quite bloody. But he was an old salt at the time of his collection. He was retired and he was living in New York's Sailor's Snug Harbour. Now, why did it make it into history and not the other version? So this is where it starts to really twisty and turny. So when he was recording his source singers, as I said, he used two different machines. And when he recorded Patrick Taylor, who was the other guy, so you've got Dick Maitland, one captain, Patrick Taylor, the other captain. Patrick Taylor's version was recorded on glass cylinder discs. And it was recorded on glass cylinder discs because this was wartime and shellac was quite hard to come by.
Yeah.
And so they recorded it on glass discs and they were shipped back to the Library of Congress because they owned the project effectively. When the Patrick Taylor versions got back to the Library of Congress, the disc on which Leaving of Liverpool was recorded had shattered in the process, in the shipping. And Derflinger, the collector, was particularly shocked by that and disappointed by that because he felt innately that this was a really important song. He could see it. And so he went back to the Sailor's Snug, and this time he took a cylinder recording device. And it's not known where he got that from, but he procured a cylinder recording device and he went and recorded Patrick Taylor's entire repertoire. And had huge amounts of wonderful things to say about Patrick Taylor, basically calling him the best singer that he'd ever heard and saying that his repertoire was hugely important.
Yeah.
What happened was that the cylinders went back to the Library of Congress, but because of their quality, possibly, and for various other reasons, they never made it to release, even though there was an album planned of Patrick Taylor's recording because they were considered so wonderful. Okay. And because Patrick Taylor also did a lot of spoken word stuff. So he talked a lot about where the song came from. Patrick Taylor, though, had a very kind of strange relationship with the truth. I mean, he's a fascinating guy and in some ways reminds me a lot of Sam Lana, who we talked about in the first episode with Nick.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that in folk song sources.
Yeah.
You know, the tall tale is far more worth recording than the truth.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And so Patrick Taylor's version goes back and it doesn't get used, but it sits in the Library of Congress. Meanwhile, the recording that he had of Dick Maitland, which was kept in his own possession, he kept in his possession right into the early 80s when Derfling himself was an old man. And in the early 80s, the Library of Congress came calling again and said, any chance we could have some of those recordings? And he said, yes, you can have them. And he gave them over. But for whatever reason, and nobody's quite sure about this, he held on to one disc.
Yeah.
And that disc was the one with Dick Maitland's Leaving of Liverpool on it. And he did say he would give it to the Library of Congress. And then he died. Died in 2000 and never did hand it over. So that version, the irony here is the version that everybody knows is the version that nobody's ever heard.
Yeah.
Whereas the version that nobody ever sings is sitting in the Library of Congress and can only be heard if you make an appointment to go and listen to it.
Yeah. So I was told, we'll come on to Paul Davenport's version in a sec, I guess.
Sure.
But I was told that there is some sort of confusion at the Library of Congress of, because there's a lack of clear permission for it somehow.
Hmm.
The Library of Congress policy is that they need the permission of a surviving relative of Patrick Taylor in order to play it to you.
Hmm.
And there are no surviving relatives of Patrick Taylor. People who've gone to request to be heard it have hit a wall of red tape.
Right.
So the only version I know of to hear that tune is the one recorded by Paul Davenport.
Who presumably heard it somehow.
Yes, I
learnt it.
He did tell me how he managed to hear it, and I can't remember the details, so
fair
I won't
enough.
Paraphrase it.
Yeah.
Well, now we're leaving Liverpool, bound out for Frisco Bay. I'm leaving my true love behind me, but I'll come back and marry you someday. And when we're on the sea, my dear, I'll always think on thee. And the day we're leaving Liverpool and the landing stage for sea, sing fare thee well, my own true love. When I return united we will be. It ain't the leaving of Liverpool that grieves me, but me darling, when I think on thee.
The Patrick Taylor version is in the Library of Congress, but it's very hard to get to hear, is the bit that you need to know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And according to this article, it's that it can be heard. You just have to make heavy appointments. But the problem with the needing to be a surviving member has to do with it being put online. So
I see. Right.
If people
okay.
want to release it,
they have to be there in person to hear it.
You have to be in person to hear it.
Right.
And they can't get it to be put online or put anywhere else,
right?
Without a member of the family, and
that would fit. Okay.
And it's, what's funny is that this article ends pretty much with the author asking people, if there's anybody out there who might have a claim on this, can you please step forward so we can do something about it?
Okay, that's really interesting. So, I mean, Steve Winnick is obviously writing this as a folk music scholar, but also as somebody who works at the Library of Congress.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting.
So again, the we're sitting here doing this with the hope that several hundred people, maybe more, will listen to this. So if you're out there, step forward and tell the Library of Congress.
Yeah, and then we can all get to hear it all. But you know, that thing of folk songs passing as Chinese whispers, I think that's an interesting point in itself, that the version that we know is the one that has been, you know, passed down possibly by Chinese whispers.
Yeah. And this is where it comes into being separated out into different sets of lyrics and that kind of thing. So the version that became very well known, as you've said, was known as a sort of forbiter or was considered to be a kind of forbiter. And what's interesting about this as well is that the dating of the song in terms of the version that everybody's knows and the version that you sing yourself, the dating of it has to do with a verse.
Yeah, so I mean, we talk about where the song is possibly from. The thing in this version that everyone's familiar with is it names a real documented person and a real documented boat. Mm. So it talks about the Davy Crockett and Captain John Burgess, you know. But so the Davy Crockett was a real boat. It was an American boat. It was launched from Connecticut in 1853, it says here.
Mm.
And 1863, John Burgess was genuinely the captain of the Davy Crockett. And it regularly visited Liverpool on voyages to and from California, which fits completely with the line. So, you know, I'm bound to California, far across the raging Maine, etc. John Burgess actually fell overboard in 1874.
You can add to that even that, and this again, you couldn't write this. He fell overboard on what was meant to be his last voyage.
Oh.
So it certainly was his last voyage.
No. Yeah, it was his last voyage.
But he was due to disembark after that.
Yeah. But, you know, possibly that as a legend, the people, it would have been a sort of knowing verse that people sang on board. But if you think about that idea that they were singing in reference to a story that everybody knew, that would probably date it 10-20 years later.
Yeah.
You know, they all know who John Burgess was in the day. And maybe him falling overboard means that his name lodged in people's memory who hadn't, you know, met him personally or sailed on board that specific ship.
Yeah.
But, you know, but we can date it to the late 1800s.
Yeah.
So if it's being recorded in 1940, that's the sort of age of that version.
Yeah.
But from what I can tell, both versions have the same chorus and different verses, different verse melodies and different verse lyrics, but the same chorus.
So here's where Taylor's version. So what we've just talked about, again, just so that people aren't confused, is the Maitland version. And that's the version that everybody knows fairly well. Now, the Taylor version doesn't mention Burgess or the ship. And in fact, let me just find my notes here, because this is really interesting. Taylor's spoken intro, because we can't get hold of it, I'm just going to have to read it out rather than play it. Here's Taylor's spoken intro to his version of the song. He says, "This is the song that was sung by the men when they were leaving the landing stage in Liverpool. The landing stage was about half a mile long, and it would hold anything from 2 to 3 ships. And every ship that was leaving there, both with emigrants and with passengers, they all had to land on the landing stage before they went to board of a ship. Now, this song, it originated in the year 1849, and it was sung with gusto by the men as they were leaving Liverpool. It was made up by a man who was leaving his sweetheart behind him and going out to Frisco in search of gold, maybe, and maybe to come back with the ship." Now, what he also goes on to talk about what the work was done around the singing of the song. So actually, Taylor's version becomes a work song and becomes what, to go back to what we were talking about before, becomes a more traditional shanty, because it had a very specific role in the ship's day-to-day life.
Yeah.
What's really interesting there is that he specifically puts it at 1849, which is a good, you know, 15 years before Davy Crockett turns up, the Davy Crockett ship turns up in Liverpool. And probably, you know, given that what we know about Taylor in terms of his sort of difficulty with the truth, is that we should probably not trust any dates that he gives, because they just appear to be randomly plucked. I mean, Taylor was a man who was born in Nova Scotia. He went to fight for the British Army in the Sudan. He ended up in the Boer region. He married a woman, a Boer woman, had 11 children with her. Because actually he was interviewed quite a lot for some reason towards the end of his life by a lot of newspapers, perhaps because it was the folk revival and they were interested in who these people were. He ended up in a lot of interviews and very rarely got the same details correct from interview to interview, like just constantly rewrote his past. And at one point he claimed to have walked further than any other living being.
Oh, brilliant.
But gave no evidence for that whatsoever. He ended up in traveling between Washington and New York, just continuously traveling, it seemed, and often took refuge in the sailor's snug. And vanishes from the records at the age of 87. It's not that there's a death certificate. He just doesn't turn up anymore. But was last seen making model ships to earn his living, and telling tall tales. Anyway, he was the idea that the song comes from 1849 specifically seems like a rather, you know, you would have to make quite a leap of faith to believe that. But what Derfflinger said of him was that, and this is a quote from Derfflinger, is that the remarkable thing about him was that despite his age, it was the strength and resonance of his voice that made it one of the best voices I've ever heard.
Yeah, but that echoes the thing that Percy Grainger said about Joseph Taylor.
Go on.
So Joseph Taylor in Lincolnshire, who, you know, the earliest wax cylinders that we have of British folk singers, he was in his mid-70s then. But, you know, there is a quote from, I can't remember the exact thing, but from Percy Grainger saying he had the most powerful resonant voice for an old man that I'd ever heard. Mm. And, you know, and we can hear that now. We can hear that he was a stunning, stunning singer.
Yeah, there's quite a few of them, aren't there? I mean, when I talked with Jackie about the Sweet Nightingale, I forget now the singer who sung that. But that person was somebody who had a great repertoire, but who struck the collector. I think it was Sharp, collector, mainly because of his ability to project those songs. And this brings into question that idea that, you know, we often talk about how that it's the song that's important rather than the singer. Well, you don't come to those songs unless the singer is able to actually put across the song in a strong enough way.
No, and there is a school of thought as well, sort of typified by, you know, Shirley Collins has this opinion that your role as a singer of folk songs is to sing them sort of devoid of emotion almost, because they're not your feelings to talk about. I think that the thing that she's said in the past is you're like a newsreader and you should sing it without, you know, without sort of judgment or emotion. But there are plenty of singers who obviously were the, you know, the polar opposite of that. It makes me think of Phil Tanner, who's known as the Gower Nightingale sometimes. But there's loads of recordings of Phil Tanner we can hear, who's the most theatrical, over-the-top singer. You know, Sam Lahner as well. Yeah. Sam Lahner was a performer. If you look at that film that Peter Kennedy took in the Blaxall ship in Suffolk, of the singers around there, you know, these people really delivering a song like a, you know, like a sort of very hammy actor. Mm. You know, that's the singing that I think captivated people. And it's the things that captivate me. And, you know, as I say, you can hear that in Joseph Taylor's voice. You know, while there's no film footage of Joseph Taylor, I'm sure he was a very sort of physical performer, because you can hear that in his voice.
Yeah.
That he's, you know, a theatrical, somebody who is, you know, living every moment of it. They're not sort of divorced from the action out of respect. They're singing this song because they, you know, because they believe in it, and they're bringing it to life.
And often, I think, often because they probably knew how good they were, and so they were being and they were being called upon to sing a song, and their ability to do that was and their reputation to do that was probably based on their ability to do it. I mean, Stephen Winnick, this scholar. I'll come into this in a bit more depth in a minute, but he talks about, and I love this phrase, he talks about these people's ability to compose in performance.
Yeah.
Composing in performance, which was the ability to, and the vast knowledge and repertoire that they had, allowing them to pull in what we call floating verses.
Yeah.
Pull in bits and pieces of other songs when they fancied it, because they knew that it would resonate with that particular audience.
Yeah.
So they were not looking at these songs as museum pieces that should be sung exactly as they were meant to be sung. These are live singing. These are live songs. They're being performed. Therefore, bits and pieces will work for certain sort of audience. And it's about the ability to read the room almost.
Yeah. I think it's worth remembering as well that quite often when you look into this stuff, you read about people having a huge repertoire. I feel like the reason that's mentioned is because it's quite unusual. A lot of performers were people who had a very small repertoire, but they were their songs that they did really, really well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They had a repertoire of three songs, and they did those were their songs that they performed the life out of, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think,
and is
I think
it not
the,
still
the
case?
Main thing was, sorry,
and is it not still the case? I mean, if you are somebody with, use that phrase, a career, you're known for a certain set of songs.
Yeah. I mean, quite often, you know, I think that a lot of folk music is based on people who really identified with a very small set of songs that spoke to them, and then they had some life experience to bring to them, and that's why they were singing those songs.
Yeah. So here's the thing with this song as well, though, that actually brings it back possibly to being an Irish song. And I really want to talk about the melody and that kind of thing after this. But Stephen Winnick, again, he points to similarities in much older songs. There are two that he brings up, particularly in relation to The Leaving of Liverpool. One, and get this for a title in terms of similarity, is The Leaving of Limerick.
Wow.
It does sound rather similar. So,
yeah.
The chorus of which includes the lines, "So farewell to the boys of Thomond Gate. It's to them that I'll bid adieu. It's not the leaving of Limerick that grieves me, but my darling, it's leaving you."
Well, that's nothing like.
Now, he also refers to a song called Swansea Town, which has an abundance of striking similarities, largely to do with the Taylor version, which has a lot of talk about sort of writing letters, about silk dresses, various things.
Yeah.
There's too many to list here, in fact. And the similarities are really striking, but that's where this idea of composing and performance comes in, because it does sound almost like that Taylor could draft in these sections because he knew other songs so well to fill the song in that moment and perhaps to suit that specific audience. So there's two examples of the song being potentially a lot older. I mean, I would have to go and actually do research into The Leaving of Limerick or Swansea Town to know exactly how old those are. But it does seem to be a song that could have been made up by from a bunch of other bits and pieces.
When you look at songs that exist in the English tradition, and the Irish tradition, and the Scottish tradition, often the bits that change are the names and the places. Like it's very easy to put Swansea in the place of, I'm trying to think of a two-syllable English place name.
Worcester.
I mean, Worcester. In fact, Oxford City, Worcester City.
Yeah,
I mean those are English ones, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely.
To make it fit a local event that a similar things happened in different places. Mm. You know, the song "The Oxford Girl" as well, being very similar to the murder of Maria Martin. You know that those patterns that can fit whenever there's a, you know, there's a slightly psychopathic murder. But, you know, the Richard Maitland one mentions some specific places that are still there in Liverpool.
Yeah.
So Prince's Landing Stage, which, as most people sing it, is the first line, "Farewell to Prince's Landing Stage." That's if you picture Liverpool with the Three Graces. Prince's Landing Stage is sort of just along from where the Three Graces are. It's where the ferry, the Mersey ferry, still goes from.
Yeah.
So it's exactly where you think it is on Prince's Parade. So, you know, that's still a feature of Liverpool today. Frederick Street is still there, I think.
Yep, looked that up this morning.
Anson Terrace runs off Anson Street up by London Road.
Okay.
Park Lane? Park Lane is still busy, running parallel to the Dock Road from Canning Place to Jamaica Street.
And I think it's those kind of, again, we talk about this a lot on this podcast, but it's that ability or that idea that possibly you can locate songs as specifically as that. So, you know, we get, it becomes really attractive, certainly to me, and I know to you and people like Nick Hart and other people, that these names and these places pop up because you kind of really feel that connection and that tangibility with the song.
Yeah, there's also a school of thought that the old singers thought visually, a lot of them thought visually. So when they were singing the song, they could picture the location.
Mm.
And it was very rooted in a sense of place in that way.
Mm.
The one I always think about, I mentioned earlier that Peter Kennedy film of the Blaxall ship.
Yes.
And the guy that sings Bold General Wolfe in that has got his eyes open, but his eyes are flickering like one of those REM sleep dreams.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I've always thought that he, you know, his eyes are open, but he's seeing the film of the song as he sings it.
His eyes,
it certainly looks like he's, you know, you could put your hand in front of his face and he wouldn't know it's there because he's seeing the movie.
Yeah. And actually, you know, it's a common question, isn't it? You know, sort of, especially when you talk to people who deal with lengthy ballads, I remember talking to Emily Portman about this and saying, you know, how do you remember something like, we were probably talking about The Cruel Mother because that's a song that we both like to sing. And I was saying, how do you pull that together? How do you remember that? And she says that she kind of almost plays the movie and watches it.
Yeah, I think that is the only way to remember. Yeah, I think it's the only way to remember long songs. Not necessarily playing the movie, because I don't tend to think visually like that. I'm a lot more sonically based, but certainly telling the story. And I think that is also how songs can drift like that, because tenses in my performance change quite often. You know, so I'm singing the song and it has the same amount of syllables and verses as it always has. And it has the same plot. But like telling it, like a storyteller telling a story, the tenses might change or the angle that you come at a line might change. And quite often I'm not even aware of it. I've just, over the course of 3 years singing a song, something's changed from the past to the present.
It's quite interesting, isn't it, that you can sometimes, I mean, certainly I've found this, is that when I've, you know, if you're making demos of a version of a song and you happen across those demos 3 or 4 years later, just quite how much that song has changed, even if it's a traditional song and you think you're trying to stay fairly close to the original, inevitably changes happen and you remember those changes.
There's a lot of technical things about singing ballads that I don't hear discussed very often as well, which have a lot in common with storytelling techniques and ways of pacing things on a both a micro and a macro level. So the way where you put the commas and the full stops, basically, and where you put the chapter, you know, if it's a long story, where you start the new chapter and how you indicate that in unaccompanied singing with a length of pause, or, you know, with an inflection that suggests this bit is closed and now we're starting a new bit, or a scene shift. How you indicate that in singing. I think because some people do it naturally and other people think that it's something that you do naturally and you shouldn't sort of discuss in detail, which I suppose is a whole other discussion about what Ewan McColl brought to the discipline of folk singing, because he was somebody who came from a theatre background and did consider these things and did talk about them. But there's that. And also there was a sort of space filling news thing a few months ago about how have young people lost the art of reading Shakespeare, and it was someone from the Royal Shakespeare Company saying we have to do a boot camp for new actors because they haven't been trained in iambic pentameter, you know, in how to say these words out loud, and they're missing a load of the bits where there are rhyming words, but they're putting the stresses in the wrong place, and there is a very specific pattern. That felt like a very similar thing, that you do have to articulate these thoughts out loud, or some of the reasons that things are like that get lost.
Yeah.
So as a performer, I do put a lot of thought and a lot of, I've put a lot of thought into developing my skills, as I said, the commas and the full stops, and how you pace a song and how you keep the flow of it. I do often think of it like, when people are taught to do screenwriting, you know, there are courses that you can do in screenwriting where you're talk about a three act structure, and at a certain point of the running time, you have to hit this marker of a dramatic thing happens.
Yeah.
And I also discuss it quite often with students about, imagine you're writing a soap opera. Well, at the end of half an hour of your soap, of your episode, you want to have that cliffhanger moment to make people come back the next day for the next episode of EastEnders, you know, that duff, 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 drum fill. But we can do that in, you know, after four verses, you want people to continue listening, because there are too many ballads where people switch off. And the reason they switch off isn't because the song is bad. It's because the performer hasn't indicated that they're, you know, they haven't kept the tension up.
Yeah.
So, you know, balancing tension and, tension and relief, it's a skill that I have put a lot of thought into.
Yeah.
And I've got sort of quite strong opinions on how you do that and ways that you can do it. And it's something that is maybe unique to ballad singing, because, you know, popular culture doesn't have an equivalent of long form songs. And in art music, in classical music, that a lot of that heavy lifting is done for you by the arrangement and the orchestra.
Sure.
And you're following that. Somebody has made those decisions, but they're on the score.
Yeah.
So, you know, that there is an art to doing it, and the people who are good at it are Luke Hillen and Norma Waterson and June Tabor and Mike Waterson, and Joseph Taylor. But there's a lot to learn from that, which I don't see many people discussing out loud.
Well, let's discuss that out loud on another occasion. Okay. But Let's go back to the Leaving of Liverpool. I'm interested in, I mean, what you've just been talking about is how you approach a song from an artist's perspective. And when we talked last time, we were talking about Tam Lin, and you were coming at that very much from a point of view as being somebody who's studied that song in depth over, you know, decades. But in this case, it's something that, you know, you've made a relatively recent decision as an artist to make to make a version of this song. And we've talked a little bit about how you came to it.
Yeah.
I'm interested in it, I suppose, as an editor, like, you know, sort of what you're picking out. And also I'm interested in, because you know so much about the musicology side of it and I don't.
Okay. So I suppose we might as well be clear about this. The reason you would have, or the reason I have The Leaving of Liverpool in my repertoire is it's Don't Look Back in Anger by Oasis. It's a thing with a soaring chorus that the audience can sing along with, it's, that you can pick up in one listening. And it's, you know, it's an example of one of those one, it's almost like football terrorist chant, you know, that which is the jackpot in popular culture.
Let me jump in very quickly. I did go and look into that as well in this, because it just means it seems like the most obvious song to have as a football terrorist chant. And yet it seems not to have ever really picked up. I mean, to me, if I was a Liverpool fan, I would be singing this when a player left the club or something like that. But actually, the only version that I've found of Leaving of Liverpool, and I would be delighted if somebody corrected me on this and told me that it's been sung for years as a terrorist anthem, but the only version that I've found is actually not connected to Liverpool FC, but to Everton FC.
Right.
And it's sung as the
They are a mile and a half apart. You know?
They are, but deadly rivals, right? So it's sung as the leaving of Goodison. So there you go. Goodison Park being where they used to play. But I've only found one recording of that. Anyway, go back to Don't Look Back in Anger.
Yeah, I just mean, you know, it's a soaring chorus that people can pick up on quickly, and that's what you're
the
looking
terrace
for.
Anthem,
So that was a reason for adding it to my repertoire. But that said, it's not something I've got a lot of, and it's not something that sort of fits with the rest of my material. So there is a consideration that I was trying to find something that would be a good set ending sing along, because I don't have any other of those.
Yeah.
Things that are familiar but you put a new slant on it are interesting. I did some sort of stealth Americanizations on it. So the first couple of verses I made up a bit that I inserted in, because now how do other people sing that line? So, fare thee well, my own true love, from sailing far away, I'm bound for California, but I hope that I'll return someday. I'm bound for California, far across the raging main. What do I even sing? Across the raging main, but I will write you letters, love, as soon as I return again. So yes, so I'm bound on board of a Yankee ship. Davy Crockett is her name.
Yeah.
John Burgess is the captain of her, and they say that she's a floating shame. And then other people sing, I've sailed with Burgess once before, and I think that I'd say I know him well, or I think I know him well. If a man's a sailor, he can get along, and if not, then surely he's in hell. So I just wanted to change that bit, really. I just had this vision of it being almost like a sort of cowboy song at that point. So I've left this city many times, I've been lonesome more than I can tell, if a man's a sailor he can get along. I think I for a bit before I recorded it, I was saying, if a man's a wanderer he can get along, and if not then surely he's in hell. That was what I was trying to get out of that line. I've been lonesome more than I can tell, if a man's a wanderer he can get along. So it was about this idea of leaving the place that you call home and being sort of self-supporting and being, you know, sort of being somebody who thrives on loneliness almost. That was what I was trying to tease out of that line, but that's my invention. Although the general feeling was already there somewhere. I think I've done other edits. I've gone through different ways of singing the chorus melody. Which, when I first started performing it, threw people off, and they didn't join in because they joined in with the tune that they knew, and that didn't fit the chords, the clever chords I put on that changed the slant of it. So I had to sort of roll it back a bit, to try and sing it my own way, but in a way that wasn't alienating.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't really put my finger on exactly what I did or why, because it's such a gradual process. And it's also, I think, a process of singing it every night on tour and trying it out and just gradually working your way through. I mean, the tempo comes, as I say, was influenced by Steve Tilston's version.
Yeah.
Because of the way I think, also, I really like this chord progression. So you've got...
So fare thee well, my own true love. When I return, united we will be.
And then this bit.
It's not the leaving of Liverpool.
So what that is a minor dominant chord.
Mm.
So it's not the leaving of Liverpool that grieves me. But my darling, when I think of thee. So I liked that chord particularly, and I think that's the compromise. You can sing the tune that everyone knows, but I still get to put in my
clever
nice
stuff.
Chord.
Yeah.
My clever stuff. So, theory wise, you'd describe that as an example of modal interchange.
Right. Okay.
But that's not important. you said about the melody.
Well, I'm interested in the melody just in terms of, you know, as we've talked about it in the past, what is it about it that why does the heart yearn so much when you hear that song? Why is the nostalgia so strong?
I don't know about the heart yearning, you know, but this is a very similar thing to when we talked about the hard times of old England. So what the melody of the verse, or this Richard Maitland tune anyway, the tune that everybody knows, is it tells you what the chords are underneath, which is very helpful for unaccompanied folk song and gives it a really strong tonal centre.
Yeah.
So do is the tonic. Do, 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 do. So that first line of melody is telling you that you're on the one chord, because we've got a strong tonic and a fifth and a third and then some passing notes between them. So it's climbing up and down that chord, really. Do, 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 do. So that's climbing, that's jumping up to the top tonic and down two notes. So if in the key of C, for instance, we'd be climbing down to an A, which sort of strongly suggests a four chord, a subdominant chord to the ear. So as with the hard times of old England, this is one which has a really strong indication of the primary chords, or as we'd call them. So it's a very, you know, it's a very easy to understand melody. It's a very easy to pick up melody. And if you're going to make up, for harmony singing, it's got a very clear idea of what the chords are. There's nothing complicated about this, and it's like Don't Look Back in Anger. It's very easy to sing along with, and it's very easy to sort of have a clear idea of what the song is, you know. It's all in focus, you could say, and the same for the chorus, you know. But so the compass of the song, we do have an octave leap. But then when we get to the chorus, do, 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 do. So we've, the top note before has been the top tonic, and we've climbed up another note to the second of the scale, which functions as the fifth of the dominant chord. So the chorus is just a little unit of space higher in the melody to give you a high point.
And you haven't been there yet, have you?
No, exactly. You reach the highest point.
And I remember seeing relatively recently, you've probably seen this yourself, I remember seeing an interview with Paul Simon where he's talking about the song Still Crazy After All These Years.
Okay.
And he's only just started. Have you not seen this? It's a
I haven't, no, but I can, I'm just picturing what he
I'm going to
would
send
say
it to you in
it.
A minute, but it's
yeah.
It's what's fascinating about it is he's only just started writing it. And he's got to the end of the verse, and now he's got to make a choice about the chorus.
So the four in the morning, the high bit.
That four in the morning bit, he hasn't done that yet. And what he's saying in this interview is, and he's got a guitar with him, but he basically tells the audience, I've got these choices now to make as a songwriter. I could do this, or I could do this. But actually what I think I'm going to do is this, because actually this set of notes that I'm about to go into, the ear has not been introduced to yet. Yeah. And therefore it's going to do something completely different to your brain. if I use those notes. And I get that sense here where you suddenly hit that really high note. It's like, ooh.
Yeah. I mean, it's really simple pop writing stuff is the chorus exists in a space that's higher than the verse.
Yeah.
And that's definitely what's happening here. And all with, as I say, all with that strong sense of what the chords, the underlying chords are.
Yeah.
You know, it's not an ambiguous tune.
Yeah.
And the folk songs that tend to have been passed on and tend to have endured are the ones that are very unambiguous about the tonal center, I feel. You know, there is a movement in pop music since the 80s of having very monotone, ambiguous melodies that stay around a few notes with chords that shift underneath.
Right. Yeah.
But folk music doesn't really work that way. Mm. You know, stuff that started out life as unaccompanied singing or is stuff for singing in the community anyway, maybe without instruments, doesn't function that way. Mm. So we have a very different slant to how harmony sort of is implied.
Unless you're Jim Murray, of course, in which case you're throwing in dominant minors or whatever you just called it.
When I talk about that idea of modal interchange with students, I think of it as a really Beatley thing to do.
Yeah,
is you're in a major key, and then the five chord you have a minor third in it. That feels like a very sort of, it's a very McCartney thing to do.
Mm.
So you know, I suppose all of the music I like, it all ties it all together. This, you know, this is where the sum of influences all meets.
Mm.
The things I like about Paul Simon or Paul McCartney are really present in this sort of song.
Yeah, absolutely. Wonderful. Have we got anything else that we can possibly say about The Leaving of Liverpool?
I'm trying to think.
But just to say, really, just to say how much I enjoyed your version. Because
thank you very much.
Because I think, you know, I think it, you're right. It's to go back to the top of this recording, there are so many songs that get left out. Because we're so hungry, your folk performers, certainly folk performers of a certain type, the likes of many, many performers who are eager to sort of explore the canon, there's an urgency amongst those people to go and find stuff that nobody has ever recorded before. Or, you know, the dream is to find the song that you know, for me, the dream was to find a song and be able to play it to Martin Carthy that he'd never heard before. You know, it's that kind of thing, right? So, and to have a song that on the surface of it is almost too obvious to do, but to do it in a way that, you know, can have people, you know, when I saw you play it here at our folk club, there was a row of people sat alongside me with tears dripping down their cheeks.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, I mean, it's one that I wouldn't have picked this to talk about because it's not boundary pushing and it's not... sort of, yeah, it feels like it's not the clever stuff, but as a consideration in how you structure a set, this has a very definite place in my repertoire that isn't covered elsewhere. So, you know, it's a song that is easy to understand, and it's a song that is easy to join in with, and it's something that gives a sense of closure at the end of the night where I've maybe demanded their attention to get through 6-7 minute songs. This is something that's, you know, that's like a nice conclusion to the evening where everybody can go home with a bit of a glow. When I've, you know, around the middle of the set, I've sort of beaten them to submission a little bit, and you know, it needs a bit of attention, as I say.
So maybe it's time that we all stop being so clever and we just go back to the songs that apparently are too obvious but everybody's avoiding. I want to hear a Nick Hart version of Scarborough Fair. Next.
Well, you know, Nick. Yeah, I mean, Nick has his catchy ones. Nick has his hits.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I mean, I tend to use that the term hits for this, not in terms of the ones that are popular, but the ones that are immediate. You know, it's like singles versus album tracks. You need a good balance of them.
Yeah.
But you know, when we were talking about how this song entered the popular consciousness, you know, it's collected in 1940. Ewan McColl hears it. What sort of time? 15 years later, maybe
12 years. Yeah.
And then there's this huge frantic. You know, Lou Killen hears it, and then he records it, and then someone else hears it from him, and then it goes back to America with the Clancys, and you know, the speed of that is that the reason for that is because of the chorus of this song.
Yeah,
this,
absolutely.
This chorus is one where obviously you hear it and you go, I want that. I want, you know, Bob Dylan hears that and goes, I want that chorus.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's because it's distilled down to such a perfect essence of, you know, as I say, I would put it down to the chord tones are so strong.
Yeah.
But it's so immediate. It's an immediate song. Yeah. And there is something to be said for balancing the immediate songs with the ones that demand your attention and unveil themselves over time. And, you know, quite often people talk about folk music as being the ultimate expression of the human condition. I'm very resistant to saying folk music represents one thing or another, whether that be, you know, folk music is exclusively the music of the working classes, or folk music is exclusively about sort of rural life. You know, you can, the evidence is there if you look for it, but you can pretty much skew it in whichever way. What folk music is, I think, is it is a sum total of the human experience. You know, it's songs that speak to some sort of universal human condition. Do you know what I mean? And this is one of those things that it's really immediate, and everyone can relate to this because it talks about a very simple emotion, which is you know, being homesick and being, you know, and
saying farewell to loved ones.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. You know, and that's probably why it's such a universal song.
Yeah.
In a way that there are some child bards with some very complicated emotions and some very, you know, some things that take some unpicking. This doesn't take any unpicking. This is, you can hear it and you can understand it and you can relate to it.
Mm, absolutely. Well, I think we have come naturally to our end. Thank you so much for the time.
No, thank you so much for speaking to me. It's always a joy.
I'm looking forward to, it's your turn next time. You choose again. I'm looking forward to seeing what you pick out next time.
My darling.
terrace in Old Park Lane. For I know that it will be a long, long time before that I see you again. So fare thee well, united we will be. It's not the leaving of Liverpool that grieves me, but my darling, when I think of thee. So fare thee well, my old true love, when I return. Not the leaving of Liverpool that grieves me, but my darling, when I